we're going to start out by having a lit session with Senate Bill 702. And Brian, do you want to cover what the bill does so that everyone understands it?
Sure, members of the committee. Senate Bill 702, as amended with the -3 amendments this evening, would place the Construction Contractors Board within the Department of Business and Consumer Services. The Construction Contractors Board currently reports to the governor, and this bill, as I said, would place the CCB within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The amendments, the -3 amendments, would also provide that a rule adopted by the Construction Contractors Board would be submitted to the DCBS director, and the director would then have 30 days to approve or disapprove the rule. The -3 amendments would also require the Construction Contractor Board to develop an application for the registration of construction contractors. It would direct the DCBS director to appoint a CCB administrator. And finally, it would provide that employees transferred from the Construction Contractor Board to DCBS would retain the same benefits, employment status, collective bargaining rights, and collective bargaining agents that they had while employed by the Construction Contractor Board.
Okay. Again, this is consistent with what we're doing with other agencies, where we're making it's concurrent. In other words, the boards make the rules, but they have to be approved by the director of the agency. So we have 30 days in which to accept or reject, and then have to go back to the rulemaking. So this is consistent with what we're doing with building codes as well.
We're saying that the Construction Contractors Board is responsible for DCBS, but potentially still is...
No, actually, the board makes the rules, and then the director approves them, but the entire agency would be under the direction then of the DCBS director at this point.
So you're saying that the Construction Contractors Board does their own rulemaking?
They make the rules.
They do that through their board, and then it goes to the director.
Yeah, presently, the board does make the rules.
Yes.
But this allows the director to
rule on the rules.
To overrule the rules if he feels that it's not acceptable. Okay? Mike, do you want to, you have anything to say on that, or is that...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mike Greenfield, director of DCBS. My understanding of the bill is there's an administrative function related to the Construction Contractors Board, which would be within the exclusive purview of the department. There's a rule and policy making function. The board would be developing those rules and policies, and then the director would have the opportunity to disapprove those, send them back with comments.
Okay, so we're doing the same thing in 803. So it used to be that rather than have the board make the rules, the director does have the ability to say that these rules aren't acceptable. But this probably is a conditional check.
Chair, it's different than we do with a number of agencies. I'm not necessarily opposed, but I'm not sure what our staff situation is right now. But I was wondering if there's any way to get this thing hand engrossed and we could come back to it before we're done tonight.
They are handing growth. Well, actually, I know. I apologize. The -3 amendments basically replace the bill.
So
you can refer to the -3 amendments.
Okay. I just like to have a chance to review. There were a number of comments made last time, and I kind of like to go through those sections and see.
Okay. Is there anything we can do to help you? Do you want to... We're going to wait for a bit before going to a work session.
I would appreciate if we could do that. I think
why don't we do that? We'll go to 803 and we'll have the same problem.
I might not care as much on that.
Okay. We're going to close the work session on 702 and we'll go to 803. And see, we have two people, that's Joe and Bob, and they're going to come up and tell us what the bill does.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Brewer. I'm the administrator of the Building Codes Division. Senate Bill 803 with the -5 amendments will basically streamline many of our activities. it'll fold three boards into one, changing the boiler board, pumping board, and the electrical board into one board, the electrical mechanical board. We believe this will help improve consistency and provide continuity for our rulemaking process. Currently, the three boards have varying roles in the rulemaking process, varying roles in the policymaking process. As Mr. Smith pointed out, this board would have rule writing authority, but those rules would be sent to the director for a review within 30 days, and then a written response to the board if the director failed to approve would be provided, and the board would have the opportunity to again act on those rules. Nothing would move forward, however, without the director's approval, and we believe that will provide a level of accountability that does not exist in some cases now.
Okay.
Happy to take any questions.
I have a question. I haven't had a chance to look at the dash five and the hand and grow, even though there's hand and grow. But in our last meeting, one of the things that was brought up is what is going to go through this mechanical, all the rules and codes and things that are supposed to go through this board,
mm-hmm.
which is...
There's five boards, but we're just combining three of them.
And making, okay. And
the other two,
and which are the other two that are left?
There's the mechanical board, no, structures board, and the manufactured building.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. There's the building code structures board, which handles the building code, the structural code, and the mechanical code. Then there's the manufactured structures board, which handles issues around manufactured structures, manufactured homes, things of that nature.
Yeah, that's maybe something for the next session to combine those. But this session, I think this is as far as we're going to get.
But, Mr. Chair, when in our last meeting, one of the individuals came up and he testified, and I think that the page he was talking about was on page 46A of the old bill, that indicated that every building code amendment would go to the electrical and mechanical board. And if that has not been changed, it did not seem appropriate that all of the building codes. Is that the gentleman that, his first name is Pat?
That's Mr. Chairman, okay. Senator Cucup has had bridges.
Okay.
He just informed me that those were the dash one amendments, and they have been
amended. So they have changed, so it doesn't do that any
longer. Okay. Bob, do you want to cover your side, please?
Very briefly, Mr. Chairman, I'm Bob Schiffrack, Lawyers and Building and Construction Trades Council. I'm just talking about the technical features of this bill and somewhat of how it would work over in this shop. Let me tell you why we've asked for the bill. Our industry in Oregon, the construction industry, is changing very rapidly. There are national codes, particularly in certain piping systems. Particularly with the advent of the high-tech industry in Oregon, some very highly technical things that are now being done. And frankly, and I brought this to Joe's attention, and he agrees with me, the state's simply not keeping up with the rapid change in our industry. So one of the things I point to in the bill that we're particularly interested in is Section 5, which would allow the establishment of advisory and technical committees made up of industry experts that can adopt national codes that are important to Oregon, advise this electrical and mechanical code, then adopt those so that Oregon stays in front of the changes in the technology. It also then, once the state has adopted these important codes, also gives us, the workers, a standard to train to through our apprenticeship program so that Oregon construction industry stays on top. We want to tell you, you're living in a state that has got some of the finest contractors and workers in the country, and we want to maintain that so that we're on the cutting edge of all the new technology and that we have the skilled people trained to perform the jobs in industry and commerce, frankly. Get two perspectives coming together.
Okay. Any questions?
Bob, what are industry experts?
These would be, I'm talking about people who who adopt codes. We'll use high tech, for instance. Some of the chemicals and solvents and the piping systems that are wired in with those are adopted, are actually being invented, if that's the proper word, as to how to deal with the needs of industry. There are people that we bring into Oregon, frankly, that are national experts on these types of piping systems, for instance. And there are other things as well as on the electrical side as well. Mr. Chairman, the things are moving rapidly, and we need to just stay on top of it. It's very important. These are very hazardous systems, very hazardous.
I'd like to tell the committee, if you ever have an opportunity to go up to the plumbing apprenticeship program or to the electrical building, you're out by the airport now, but they're a fantastic facility. If you just go look at what they're doing to train people, and they're doing it on their own, they're not taking $8 or $7 involved, and they do a fantastic job. Right?
Mr. Chairman,
sure.
Section 5 says that you may establish such advisory and technical committees as the board considers necessary. Would you expect that sort of the old groupings would emerge as a subcommittee, that there would be an electrical technical advisory committee, a plumbing technical advisory committee, those things? Because one of my concerns, honestly, has been we've had, I think, some pretty well-rounded boards, and I'm not necessarily opposed to merging them, but there are people who gain a lot of expertise and you know, folks who work with the tools who I want to make sure have a say on that.
Through the chair to Senator Dukes, I agree, and I would fully expect that these technical advisory committees would in many cases be made up of some of the same folks that have participated on boards and committees in the past. At the same time, Mr. Shipwreck's point is accurate. The codes are moving forward rapidly, becoming more and more technical. In my mind, it's almost impossible for any one board, any one group of people to have all the knowledge necessary to make informed decisions. I've worked within a system similar to this in Washington State, sat on the Building Code Council there, and the use of technical advisory committees in that case was very successful. So I look forward to a time when we can both pull together ad hoc committees to address highly technical issues, give advice to a board that's accountable through the director for the decisions they make.
Okay. Any other questions?
Just one other We did hear from somebody last time that testified that was going to help modify this membership, the base. Did they come forward with any ideas? I think he was on the elevator board or was an elevator board
member.
Sure. Senator Cusa, we do have a provision on page 2 at lines 9A through 9B that talk about the report that will be made to the 71st legislature, and that's on the Hannon Gross version.
Okay.
That would,
okay.
They're going to deal with that in the interim.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, we're in a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 5 amendment.
Okay, is there any objections to the dash 5 amendment? Hearing none.
Chair, I move that Sunbelt 803 as an indicator to do pass presentation.
Okay, if you have a roll call vote, please.
Senator Miles.
Aye.
Senator
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Okay, pass, and are you ready to do this? The 702, Ms. Duke?
Mm-hmm.
Are you ready to move this Okay.
Okay.
Everyone said it because you may have to carry it.
Well, this is going to be for you.
Okay.
Who'd like to hear from? We're going to open a discussion on 702. Who'd like to hear from?
I also had trouble with the transfer of the employees.
And that is taken care of.
You want to have Ralph come forward?
Yeah, you would just
Ralph, do you want to come forward? Ralph, do you want to see me? I saw him come in.
What was the change from going from Bowie to DCBS? What?
Why did we have DCBS that anymore?
Well, didn't we start at Bowie and work our way to DCBS?
The goal was to go to Bowie, but Bowie was a rather small agency and it's not a big attention.
Yeah, I didn't think so, but
we do have in the bill that when the transfer is made, that all of the benefits go with the employee and they stay with the same bargaining unit. Yeah, Ralph, you want to tell us that you're comfortable with what we're doing with 702, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ralph Groner with AFSCME. We ask that we have employee transfer rights placed into the bill shall not be subject to any reduction in compensation, benefits, employment status, et cetera, and we're okay with that if that occurs.
Okay.
Have you looked at the dash 3?
This is dash 2 I have.
We're operating on dash 3.
Okay.
It has the same
amendment, I assume, that they brought in. Okay, let me look at that. I don't mean to be negative.
That's right. I already get one shot at it.
Dash 3. God, they're cold. Bargaining rights, obligations. That's the same amendment.
Yes.
Thank you.
And I have one question if I could, Mr. Greenfield.
Mr. Greenfield.
Not having had a chance to pick these apart, I'm looking at the staff mission summary that says one of the things that you would have to do is appoint a CCB administrator. Do you expect to open the position?
For the record, Mike Greenfield.
Advertise.
DCBS. My expectation is that I'd like to carefully review the staffing that's there, and it's certainly within the realm of the probable that we'd open it up and have a recruitment, but I'm not familiar enough with the administrative issues related to the contractors board to want to make a firm commitment at this juncture about what process we'd use. However, the bill does, I think, without question, deposit in my office full responsibility and accountability for managing it, and it was my intention to make sure that gets done in a way that doesn't have me answering tough questions in front of committees like this.
We're not tough anymore.
The question is going to be tough, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
I'd like to hear from Fred Bonato.
Okay, Fred.
He's got a bit of history in this.
He's the one who started it, I think. Right, sir, Fred?
Do you have a specific question, or do you want to give me 90 seconds?
I'd like to give you 90 seconds.
I am Fred Vanatta, appearing before you on behalf of the Oregon Building Industry Association. It is correct that the creation of this board was the first bill that the Home Builders Association brought to this body and was adopted, and I was the person who carried it through the process. The board at that time was placed in the Department of Commerce. The board had hired their own staff and essentially ran their own program, and the builders, contractors who served on the board complained every biennium about the surcharge for administration of the Department of Commerce that was placed, that the people who paid the contractors board expenses, that is, the registration fee. They complained every 2 years about how much money they were paying for the Department of Commerce superstructure. Now, I had absolutely nothing to do with the abolition of the Department of Commerce, but as those of you who were around here at the time who did that won't remember, they talked about saving millions and millions of dollars when we abolished the Department of Commerce. At that time, the board was, in effect, set aside as an independent board. It's our opinion that, and there had been some rough spots along the way, particularly when construction took off, if you will, in the mid-90s, and the Ways and Means didn't staff up the board as fast as they needed to be staffed up to handle the paperwork, and there were some rough spots along the way. But by and large, the board has done very well as an independent agency. If I remember correctly, in the first biennium, it had either three or five people as staff, and now there are 40-some thousand contractors registered with the board, and it is plenty large enough to stand alone and operate by itself. We see no benefit to this transfer, and our instructions from our contractors are to be crossways of this proposal and not support it. And I haven't heard any list of things that would be significantly improved by such a transition. I have the utmost respect for Mr. Greenfield and his staff. He is top flight and top rate, but he isn't always going to be there, and I might just quickly point out to you that he is presently looking out for and making sure that the insurance division, the workers' comp division, the appraiser board, OSHA, banks, savings and loans, pawnbrokers, sellers of travel, the Office of Energy, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, and the Building Codes Agency stay on the straight and narrow. That is a pretty big bite for one person. And I'm not sure that there's anything to gain by putting the 50 or 60 employees in the Construction Contractors Board over there and trying to put him in charge of overseeing the rules that the Construction Contractors Board approves. So we would urge you not to go forward with this bill.
I would point out, Fred, that the director wouldn't be doing, it would be the same person doing the rule approving if the person was done. It's not done by the director of DCDS.
Well, if I read the Dash 3 amendments correctly, which I think may be different from the earlier one, the director must review the rules that are adopted and either veto them or let them go into effect. So there's it is certainly a substantial change in the operation of the board.
Well, there needs to be a correction there because that was not the perfect question. I appreciate you calling that to attention. So we are going to close this session before the government group of the new tomorrow. And we're going to open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 1061. Yes. Okay, we're going to have a work session on 1061. Do you want to come up and tell us the compromise you made? And we are running a little bit behind, so we want to get this done really quickly.
Yes,
sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, John Chandler, Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Building Industry Association, here on Senate Bill 1061. We had a discussion of this bill last week in this committee in a kind of different form, and the chair asked us to go off with the cities to work out an agreement. The police will now, if we have one, I very much appreciate the hard work that both City of Portland and the League of Cities have put in crafting this. You should have in front of you the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 1061. The original bill has been deleted. We are inserting in its place the language on the dash one. And what this bill does essentially is dealing with the issue of system development charges for parks. Under Oregon law, you can charge an SDC for water, sewer, streets, and parks. With regard to parks, we have had a difficulty over the years of differing levels of service being chosen, one higher level for the SDC and then a current level for the existing residents of the city. This bill attempts to address that by saying that before you can adopt an SDC for a higher level of service for new residents, you have to have in place some mechanism to get the current residents up to that same level of service, so that if the new residents are paying for tennis courts or soccer fields or whatever, and the people currently living there don't have enough tennis courts or soccer fields or whatever, under this bill, there would have to be some mechanism by the city to get the soccer fields and tennis courts for the current residents while the new residents are paying for theirs through the SDC. The language, if I may, Mr. Chairman, we are going to be making, so the committee is aware, we will be making one change over in the House that has been agreed to, at least some parts, mostly in concept, some language in terms of time. We didn't have enough to bring it to you tonight. But just so you know, in the lines 8, 9, and 10 of the Dash 1 Amendment, we're going to be adding language in front of the word mechanisms, a plan that describes one or more mechanisms, so we don't lock the cities into just one system. And then the words on line 9, then ensures, are going to be changed to achieve or design to produce. And then also we're going to add language that tries to put the time period on this, so it didn't make it clear that the cities don't have to have the money in the bank at the time they do the SDC. We put language in that ties the time period for the current residents' money to the same time period as set forth in the parks plan. So whatever period of time the SEC is covering, that'd be the period of time this local government has to raise the real level of service for everybody else. We are completely in agreement with those amendments. The city, as they can testify for themselves, are also in agreement. The balance of the bill, and thanks to the city of Portland for pointing this out, under current law, you can bankrupt SDCs. You can use the bankrupt system of terming out payment. It appears that you cannot bankrupt parks SDCs, which came as quite a shock to a number of us because we've been bankrupting parks SDCs right along, but the bankrupt statute didn't list parks, and so the Section 3 of the bill corrects that by adding parks to the list of facilities for which bankrupt financing is available. And hopefully nobody did anything too illegal in the last 12 years while we didn't notice this little glitch in the statute. With that, Mr. Chairman, that's the presentation on the bill. Thank you very much for hearing it, and your time. Appreciate it. I'm glad to take any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to get Section 2, and I'd like an idea of what the same level of park service throughout the jurisdiction means, because, I mean, take Portland, for an example. Fourth Park is huge. And there's no way you can balance that body of land throughout the area. And so this wording would seem very difficult to carry out.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wells, what would happen in a typical situation, and I'll use Forest Park, the city of Portland, let's say, adopts a parks plan that would call for X number of acres of open space per resident. In the event that was not satisfied by having Forest Park within their jurisdiction, if they adopted a higher level of service for new residents to be buying additional open space on top of the current, then they'd have to have some mechanism in place to buy additional open space for the current residents, if you will. It's fairly typical when jurisdictions do park SDCs to phrase them in terms of tennis courts per 1,000, little league fields per 1,000, neighborhood parks per 1,000, some level of park service to population. And what we're trying to get at here is if the jurisdiction adopts a plan under which their current system is inadequate, in other words, they adopt a plan that is higher than what they currently provide to their citizens, then if new residents are paying at that higher level, they're not getting the benefit of the bargain. they're building, essentially they're fixing a pre-existing deficiency the same way they'd be if it was a FCC being paid for road maintenance, which is not legal.
Thank you. So by your explanation, in fact, if the city of Portland put all of their parks on the west side of the river, you could still have people on the east side, then it would still satisfy the same level of park service throughout the jurisdiction. Is that what you're saying, that people on the east side would still have to pay their possibly a system development charge even though all of the parkland is getting developed on the west side of the river? That would still be within the jurisdiction, but by the wording it seems as if same level of park service throughout the jurisdiction would seem to me to require more equitable distribution.
That's exactly what we're trying to get at. Is that
okay.
Point.
Okay. So your first example wasn't quite on point.
That's a known happening.
Yes, I've noticed. Thank you.
Chair Durfler, members of the committee, Lynn McNamara from the League of Oregon Cities. I think John has done a good job of presenting our agreement. We think it's a reasonable compromise, and we appreciate the opportunity to come to the compromise.
Good. We appreciate you working together and making it happen. Just a comment, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Marge Kapoor, representing the City of Portland. We did work with Mr. Chandler on improving, I think, Senate Bill 1061 substantially, and he was gracious enough to put forward Section 3 of the bill, which does correct the deficiency in our ability to Bancroft Park SDCs along with other SDCs for developers who have approached us and asked for that. We apparently have a very picky and conservative bond council who pointed this out to us and told us we couldn't do it without a law change.
We care too much of
I just wanted to double check here. It appears to me we have gone from water, sewer, transportation, and parks to simply parks. Am I correct?
Mr. Chairman, there's
with
the amendment.
That it were so simple. No. Although that's not a bad idea, it was going to be conceptual amendments in the Senate. All the things Section 2 does trying to do is apply this level of service standard to parks. The rest of the SEC law is unchanged.
You came in with a proposal to say for water, sewer, transportation, parks, you couldn't go above the minimum standard. The cities couldn't charge more than the minimum to meet it, and now we're only dealing with the issue of not providing more in the way of parks than...
That's correct, Congress, and the reason for that is that in most cases, and I've worked in a lot of FCCs, in most cases, the level of service issue simply doesn't arise with regard to water, sewer, and streets. It's just not there. If you build a water system in a subdivision, that serves that subdivision. It doesn't serve any other part of town. People from the other part of town don't come over and drink out of the faucets. Parks are a different beast, and that's the reason for this amendment, is to get out of the issue that only affects parks SDCs.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, we're going to do the other session.
Chair, I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 1061.
Any objections to -1 amendment?
I move Senate Bill 1061 as amended to the floor with the two-pack recommendation.
Okay, have a roll call vote, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Carried. Okay, we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1181. And let's see, we have Chris Dudley, Ray Allen, and Ron Wilson as first people who would like to speak. Okay, we came forward, please. Do you want to introduce your guest and tell us a little bit about him?
Certainly. Chair, members of the committee, My name is Chris Dudley. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon School Boards Association, 1201 Court Street Northeast in Salem, Oregon. I'm here to talk to you tonight about a concept called a qualified economic offer. On my left is Ray Allen, who is the Deputy Administrator of Corporate and Consumer Services for the state of Wisconsin. But in his other life, he's also a board member of the Madison, Wisconsin School Board and chair of its Human Resources Committee. And on my far left is Ron Wilson, our Director of Labor Relations, who's here also for backup technical testimony if we need it. Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 1181 would establish a qualified economic offer concept in Oregon. What does it do? It creates a safe harbor for public school districts during collective bargaining by allowing a local school board to tender a qualified economic offer, a proposal for salary and fringe benefit increases, and avoid the cost and time associated with collectively bargaining salary and fringe benefits for the union. Senate Bill 1181 proposes a solution that has been successfully used in the state of Wisconsin for 6 years. It allows a school board to make a fair offer for teacher salary and fringe benefit increases and at the same time control its costs. If the district makes a qualified economic offer, then no further bargaining would be required on salary and fringe benefits. Talks would continue over language issues until the parties reach settlement. Under this bill, a school board, if it so desired, could bargain salary and fringe benefit increases higher than the level of the qualified economic offer, or it could negotiate salary and fringe benefit increases that were lower than the qualified economic offer. So it does not, in and of itself, stop bargaining or create any kind of glass ceiling on it. Why do we need this in Oregon? The amount of conflict that's generated by recent collective bargaining activities in school districts with high conflict negotiations causes critical resources to be diverted into collective bargaining, while painting a picture to the public that education is merely fighting among themselves and not paying attention to the important business of educating children. Changes in state funding for public schools, the call for smaller class sizes, the demands for higher student achievement, the increasing pressure on limited state revenues, and increasing pressures and militancy from public employee unions to give large salary and fringe benefit increases are creating a higher demand for fiscal and program accountability. Senate Bill 1181 is not a punitive measure. It is a tool that allows flexibility.
We're not going to have any outbursts in the audience. If we do, we're going to have to leave. So this is a serious issue that we're going to talk about, and we have a right to discuss it. And anybody who doesn't feel that way can leave right now.
Chairman, Senate Bill 1181 is not a punitive measure, but a tool that allows flexibility for school districts to better control their expenditures. In Oregon, teachers are well paid. We rank among the top states in average teacher salaries across our country. For example, the Oregonian reported an American Federation of Teachers survey that showed in 1997-98, Oregon, with an average salary of $42,301, ranked 13th in the United States. In 1991-92, Oregon ranked 19th in the United States. Consequently, over the last decade, teachers have made significant improvements in their pay relative to other teachers in the United States. Perhaps 10 or 15 years ago, one could argue that teachers are not well paid. However, that argument seems less credible today. This bill does not require any school district to make a qualified economic offer. But if the circumstances dictate it, then a school board can provide a reasonable salary and fringe benefit package, thus avoiding spending large quantities of time on negotiations and allowing the focus to shift back to educating kids. The flexibility of this arrangement allows local control at the same time that it provides adequate avenues for employees to make their wishes known. What it does not do is allow continued escalation of collective bargaining to levels and consequences that are unacceptable at a time when we need to focus our resources and our energy on improving student achievement. Education is a vitally important function in our society, and compensating teachers for their hard work is essential. But we do need to price it at a price that we can afford. As the struggle for salaries versus programs becomes increasingly visible, as in Sandy, Fern Ridge, Newburg, Forest Grove, Gresham Barlow, Rogue River, and Springfield in the last 2 years especially, the community becomes increasingly aware of the dispute. A lack of community support for schools exacerbated by increasingly public disputes over the internal workings of school districts, poses a serious threat to the development of quality schools and quality education in Oregon. As Ken Cole, my counterpart in Wisconsin, says, and I quote, "When citizens become disconnected from their schools and refuse to support educational programs, schools are bound to fail. We can't let that happen. School districts, taxpayers, and students need the QEO to ensure quality educational opportunities. The QEO is an important element in cost containment measures while still allowing a reasonable increase in salary and fringe benefits for teachers in the context of the larger goal of controlling expenditures in order to focus resources on the key work of school boards, which is improving student achievement." Mr. Chairman, one of the reasons we asked Mr. Allen to be here is Wisconsin has been under this kind of a concept for the last 6 years, and he's a board member in Madison, which is the capital city and a large urban district, and has had experience and has some knowledge of collective bargaining and labor relations. And it's my pleasure to stand in for you.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It's certainly an honor to be in the great state. I was asked to provide a little background on Madison. I'll do that briefly and certainly would be willing to answer any questions that you or the committee would have. The Madison Metropolitan School District is the second largest in the state of Wisconsin. It's in the second largest city in the state of Wisconsin. We roughly have 25,000 students. We have a budget of around $241 million. We have 4,300 employees, 2,500 of whom are teachers. As was mentioned, the QEO, or the Qualified Economic Offer, was passed by our Wisconsin legislature in 1993, basically to provide property tax relief. It was one-third of what I would call a three-pronged wedge to a stool. First was the cost controls on the school districts, then certainly a two-thirds funding commitment from the state of Wisconsin to the school districts, and then the Qualified Economic Offer. And one would ask, why the QEO? Well, certainly, when you put cost controls on a district, you've got to provide some mechanism for the board as a management tool to control your largest costs. And that was certainly important. The employee costs, employee salaries, and benefits. And that's why the QEO was put in place. And how did we get to 3.8? Well, at the time the legislation was put in, the cost of living was at 2.1%, and the general cost of benefits in school districts was 1.7%. thereby the 3.8. The QEO had three components to it in Wisconsin, about four components that I want to talk about. First, if it's imposed, it maintains both the existing employee benefit package and the district's percentage contribution level to fringe benefits. The employer must provide any annual funding increases to maintain the fringe benefit package, up to an equal to amount of 1.7% of the total compensation and fringe benefits cost per full-time employee. On cost less than 1.7% of the benefit piece, the savings must be passed on onto the employee's salary scale. So if the benefits come in at 1.5%, then you take the other 0.2% and transfer it down to the benefit piece.
Sharon, on your school, are they funded totally by the state, or do you have some local funding as well as state funding?
We have state funding, and we do have some ability to tax. We have the ability to go to referendum if we exceed the cost controls that are put in place, and the cost controls are per student amount that the state gives, and that's a rolling determination every year, obviously. But if we exceed that amount, or want to exceed that amount, we have to go to referendum or to the taxpayers to capture the additional money. And
what percentage of it is paid by state?
Two-thirds.
Two-thirds and then one-third from local property tax?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
The other piece is that the board must provide a total annual average increase in the cost of all salary items of at least 2.1% under the QEO.
Do you have a cap? We have a cap on our property tax of like $5 per school. Do you have something like that?
We have a cap. I couldn't give you the exact. It doesn't function in that manner. We have a cap on each school district on its capacity to expend, if I may, in terms of our budget. the formula is so complicated, I couldn't explain it. I think probably maybe two or three people in the state that probably can explain it. I'm not one of them. But we have a cap on the amount of money that the district can spend. And the state supplies a certain amount cheaper. And then we can tax for the difference between that and our cap.
So if the state pays two-thirds of it and one-third from the public, then the public, can you go through a referendum or through a tax method and raise above that?
Yes, we can. If the we have to go to referendum to go above the cost control.
So we can't do that because we have a cap of...
Yes, that's what I understand.
Okay.
We can go to referendum. And one of the reasons, if I may, that when this was put in place, one of the things that I think is important to remember is that as our salary, our wage packages kept increasing, we were running at about 7 or 8% before the cost controls and QEO were put in. And we were losing public confidence in our school from the public standpoint. They felt that we were not, that the money wasn't getting focused on the primary objective of why we were there, and that was educational quality for the kids. And one of the things that has occurred during the years is that we have, I think, for a large part, restored some confidence in our fiduciary manner of how we've addressed finances within school districts in the state. And that has allowed districts to go to referendum to capture money to do other things, to support technology, to support maintenance for buildings. There's a referendum that is up in one of the districts now to exceed the cost control, and perhaps, I don't know how they're going to spend the money if it was for, it didn't say for buildings, because that would be dedicated. So I'm assuming that they probably have some programmatic areas that they want to approach. But there have been some fairly large referendums that have passed now that were in the past, they were failing.
When you offer this economic package of 3.8 or whatever the figure, I suppose you set that each session as to what that amount would be. But and then you can still go for referendum, and would you get more dollars in, and those dollars would be spent for other programs rather than salaries? Or
yeah, depending on how you shape. Let me go back. How you would shape a referendum. I mean, you could go for, you could in fact go to exceed the cap for salary if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
You could do that. There's nothing that precludes the district from doing it.
Through a referendum.
Through a referendum.
Okay.
But if I may go back, Mr. Chair, we have 426 districts in the state of Wisconsin, school districts. When I talked to the School Boards Association, roughly no more than 5% of them, which would be about 20 districts, had imposed the QEO.
5%?
Yeah, roughly that. I'm using their figures. No more than 5% had imposed it. So that's roughly 20 districts out of 426 that had actually imposed the QEO. The majority, the vast majority of districts, continue to settle their contracts in a negotiated manner. We in Madison have never imposed the QEO. We have never imposed the QEO. Now, I must say that has the qualified economic law had a dampening effect on contract settlements? The answer to that is yes. Yes, it has. Before the law was passed, our settlements in Madison were running at about 7.4 or 7.5%. After the law, now we're running at about 4.2, somewhere in that range in terms of our total package. But we are continuing to negotiate or find mechanisms to settle our contracts without imposing the QEO.
When you do the contract, starting in with negotiations, do you have to say that we are going to use the qualified, or is that just something setting the background that you can implement anytime you choose to during the negotiated process?
It's there in the background.
Okay.
I don't think, and I can't speak for all districts, I don't think anybody that serves on the Board of Education wants to go in there and impose anything on anybody other than quality education. I don't think that our intent, I think, on most boards is to try to negotiate a settlement. It is a tool. Where I think it has been imposed is in districts that have declining enrollment. Since the dollars are attached to children, if in fact
the number, the enrollment declines, the amount of state aid you get declines, and your cap or your amount that you can spend drops correspondingly. So I think those districts are fighting very hard to maintain a certain level of quality and have come to the conclusion that they just cannot afford to have wage and benefit settlements that would exceed, you know, the 3.8.
Okay.
If I may just
share
a couple of brief. I think there have been some positives that it has helped us restore public confidence in school, especially particularly in fiscal matters. It has, in a lot of cases, shortened the bargaining process. Obviously, boards now, and certainly the unions, recognize that, you know, boards can impose the QEO and have really shortened this bargaining process in a lot of cases. It has forced labor and management to more closely examine how we do business in the district, to look for efficiencies in service, and to evaluate programs for their effectiveness. And fourthly, it has forced the boards, and I speak from our board because we have a very, very strong teachers union. It has forced us in the union to establish methods to reach settlement in a non-disruptive way. And we've had some very positive things come out of our settlements that we never had before. We formed a committee to deal with the common good, to examine how we address public opinion and other issues relative to the school district and perception of the citizenry. We've established a committee to review our health insurance. Our health insurance is written into our labor negotiations. They actually pick the provider of the health insurance. It is a Cadillac package. I'm not criticizing it from that standpoint, but as the money becomes tighter, we need to do some things different with our health insurance, and now the union, after many years of resisting it, is sitting down with us and discussing it. And I think we'll be able to hopefully come to some resolutions of how we can do the insurance a little better and make it a more cost-saving.
How many strikes have you had in the state in the last couple of years?
We haven't had any strikes because it's illegal to strike in the state of Wisconsin.
Oh, okay. That's why you don't have any strikes.
We have had the last negotiations with our union 2 years ago. It was very difficult. They didn't strike, of course, because it's illegal. But they sure caught a real bad flu and got sick quite often and slowed down.
You don't call that a strike, though.
That's not a strike.
Okay.
That's not a strike. but I think, you know, certainly change is hard. And this has been very difficult. And I think many of the teachers here will feel, as many of the teachers in Wisconsin felt, that they are being singled out solely. And I certainly respect that. But as a tool, I don't believe, and I've got to believe that the boards here care as much about kids and care as much about their teachers as the boards in Wisconsin, that I don't think anybody lightly will impose this. I think the goal is to negotiate a settlement and to try to put in perspective that it's another tool that is there for management when a settlement can't be reached, so we don't have disruption of school for young people.
As you negotiate through the contract and you don't reach agreement, then can you apply the qualified economic option?
If you need you would go to our labor relations board,
mm-hmm.
and they would have to declare that you have reached impasse.
Okay.
And then you've got some criteria that are there, but then once you had reached impasse or they had declared you had reached impasse, then you could impose the QEO if you so desired.
Okay.
What our board has done, if I may, we have decided, along with the union, to set up some processes to go to mediation and then arbitration. Now, once they passed the QEO law in Wisconsin, you didn't have arbitration anymore available to the teachers. But we as a board decided that we would extend them that right, that we would waive our right, and basically we're saying we won't impose the QEO because we had a memorandum of understanding. And I want to keep coming back to that point because while I understand the teachers feeling that this is punitive, on a local level, I think it certainly makes the board think about how they want to handle bargaining. It brings the union, I think, to a point to understand that maybe they need to bargain in a different manner. But the goal is the same, to be fair and equitable to the teachers, but recognize there's a limited amount of funding for all of us, and that we have to use those resources as best possible for the kids, and they can't all be consumed into wages and benefits. Again, I would say that the QEO law does not prevent individual districts from proceeding in a traditional bargaining path. It only establishes a guideline, a benchmark, in which the bargaining process can be framed. And you know, I'll say in closing that only, you know, you can make a judgment of whether it's in the best interest of your state's children. I can tell you that in our district, the quality of education has not eroded because of the QEO law. In fact, Madison, Wisconsin has been chosen the number one city twice in the last 5 or 6 years, the number one city in the United States. I mean, every one of those surveys, one of the strongest factors in that was the high rating of our school district, cited each time. That's a testament to our citizens and their support for public education. It's a testament to our teachers and our administrators, and I hope a commitment that our board is doing a fairly good job. And yes, it also demonstrates that the QEO has not destroyed a great school district. So I thank you for your indulgence, and I wish you well in your efforts to improve the quality of education in this state.
Mr. Allen, after 6 years, are the teachers more comfortable with it, or are they still having difficulty with it?
I think they, and quite honestly, they are unhappy with it.
Okay.
Yes. Are they uncomfortable with it? Yes. Have they learned to live with it? Yes. It has not been imposed. And we are bargaining. Our bargaining is better now than it was before, quite frankly, and I think if our union would say that. We are making great strides to discuss and work with the union and the union with us in a manner that is far more positive for our community, far more positive for our kids than ever before.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Allen? We don't have a question because we came to that.
Okay. Mr. Allen, how do Wisconsin's teacher salaries compare with Oregon?
I can't tell you that right offhand. I can tell you that our average teacher salary in Madison is roughly around, don't hold me exactly to this, $42,000 to $44,000. Yours is $42,000, I think, is what I saw in the survey. I can't tell you what it is overall for the state. There's, you know, some variance. So I would say it's probably lower.
Do you know what a beginning teacher salary is in Madison again?
Roughly under the present salary scale, $24,000 to $25,000. It'll probably increase. We're in the process of negotiating right now, so I'm sure it's going to increase.
Mr. Chair, I have a couple of questions for Mr.
Dunley. You're sure welcome to use it.
Okay.
I'm just back
here. Mr. Dunley, a couple of times in your testimony, a reasonable salary and fringe benefit package, still allowing a reasonable increase in salary and fringe benefits. What do you consider reasonable? Or what makes 2.1% reasonable?
Oh, you have to understand that the 2.1 and the 3.8 are total package costs. So if you've got movement inside there in terms of who's retiring and who's coming in, that allows that money to be used on the salary schedule itself. You can't look at a 3.8 and say that's what the salary is. Particular mix between how employment is changing and how the salary schedule is structured in that particular district.
Except that the way current is working at the moment, we have just lost a whole bunch of experienced teachers. So I think you've taken a lot of that, maybe even more expensive end off out of the kitchen.
It's going to depend on the mix in that particular district. Remember, they don't have to use. I think the issue is, you know, the is that this creates a glass ceiling of some kind, and what it will be, I believe, is it will accommodate the demand considerably. So if a teacher unit comes in with a 15% demand, they got to think about that next time, because the CEO is up
state partisan that this and don't have to. I think what you're going to see is you're going to see the cost of the association. Reasonableness of a particular salary increase, I think, is to some extent going to be defined in the community. I think teachers are in a better position vis-a-vis the rest of the community now than they have been. 3.8 is right for Oregon. I don't know the answer to that.
What has the average increase been in the last? What's the average increase been in the last 5 years?
I'd like to defer to Mr. Wilson for that information. I think he's got it.
The average increase for teachers in the last 5 years.
Salary and benefits.
I'm Bob Wilson, I'm Director of Labor Relations.
The average increase in 1997-98 to the average teacher salary is 2.94%.
Yes, for the average beginning teacher?
No, the average teacher.
Okay. And that includes benefits?
That's just salary.
Okay.
In 1996-97, the average increase was 3.49%. 1995-96, the average increase was 2.39%. 1994-95, the average increase was 2.14%.
John, does that include the steps too?
No, that is just the average increase to the teacher's salary. That would include step increases or any column increases, yes, it would.
Okay.
Do you have the ability to add fringe benefits to that so we can get a
I could give you an overall estimate. The cost of fringe benefit increases is probably in a half to a percent of salary. And the reason that that's relatively low is that during the last 5 years, we've had some years that the insurance premiums have had no increases or a very small increase.
Is that true this year?
This year, the about a 5% increase in insurance premiums overall.
I would expect that.
Thank you very much. I'd like to ask in terms of, does this really give you unfair bargaining power? And I want your perspective because, I mean, the courts have long held that if people are not on equal footing in terms of bargaining, that you cannot really declare that it is an unbiased situation. And it would seem to me, even if this were not mandatory and simply available, to be able to hang it over the head of the people bargaining should certainly be deemed an unfair bargaining advantage. And I'd like your reaction.
The flaw is 23 years ago we included it. Armor people want to go on strike.
You're inside your micro because
the armor meatpacking people want to go on strike. The board that decides that issue isn't in that community. They may be 50, they may be thousands of miles away. And they can change, they can pick up, move to another state if they want to stop operation there. So there's a power there for management side that we don't have in the public sector. What happens to our board members when they draw the line is they suffer severe consequences, whether it's a boycott of their own business, or whether it's telephone calls at night, or it's talking to their kids in the classroom. It's a different kind of pressure there. And I think when you look at what's happening in Oregon and the confrontations we're having with public in public schools between elected board members that live in that community and a $12 million a year union that can mobilize very quickly and very effectively, boards do not have equal power at the bargaining table with the union. It's just not fair.
Could I follow up?
Yeah,
thank you.
Keep going,
take it. That could take a while. The other thing is the statistics that were given to us in terms of increases have come during a period of really truly low inflation. We've had quite an incredible run here that personally I don't think will hold, especially in seeing a pickup in the gold market. And if we see much change in oil, which hit prices that actually were lower than when OPEC was first formed, you can't rely on that forever because they'll simply stop producing it. These increase figures, they're going to be in statute, and they are not flexible other than at the will of the legislature, which, having been in the legislature, I can tell you, making these kinds of numbers be truly political in nature worries me no end. Is that really the best way of going?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wilde, it's after 5 o'clock, you don't have to listen to
the old practices are hard to break, sir. The problem I have with that is the fact that we're talking about a situation here where it's a classic confrontation between who raises the money and who spends the money, and that's a change in the last decade. We used to raise 70% of the money. If we wanted to spend it on this, that's fine. Now, actually, the people pay you the 70% of the money that's then reallocated back to us. And in a time when we're looking for a way to improve instruction and enhance some of the programs, the concept in some communities of the union is every dollar that you get is a salary and fringe benefit dollar. And the balance of power and bargaining at the table is not such that a lot of districts can resist that. So if you're really interested in channeling that money to a certain way in school districts, you have to either mandate that we spend it that way, which we don't want necessarily, or you start talking about statewide bargaining because you're not sure that we can maintain our position with the union in that bargaining process. Or you talk about some other concept where you change the balance of power there, it forces the union to be a little more reasonable about their demands, and they understand that there's a safe harbor here for a board that can then say, this money is not going to be used for that, this money is going to be used to reduce class sizes, buy textbooks, put music back in the schools, etc. And I think that's why I don't think it's an unfair situation here. In terms of the dollar amount that's right in there for an escalator, I don't know if 3.8 is right. I don't know whether you want to look at an escalator that's based on some kind of formula, which you could devise a formula based on some other factors. But you still don't have to use it. It does not have to be imposed. And so I think you need to keep that in mind. It's there as a safe harbor, but it's not required. So I don't think the flat amount of percentage in the statute is as important as if it were capped, because it's not. However, if you want to exceed that cap, I think there are going to be political pressures in your community to look at why you're doing that. So a district that does decide, as Madison has in two rounds of bargaining, to not invoke the QDO, they needed a rationale in their community why they were going to do that in front of this floor. So I think it's actually a better situation for community involvement than what we have today.
Okay. Chris, I have a question, because I know the governor talked a little bit about, I think, especially a little about going to state collective bargaining, and we're looking at that seriously again. I've always resisted that because I think local control is better. Could you give me your thoughts? Do you think that's something we're looking at to see, is there something we want to do? Since the state now is paying 70% of the cost, give me your thoughts on collective bargaining statewide, if that's something that we should really seriously consider.
I've looked at state contracts, and I don't think their management provisions are any better than ours are. I'd just soon not administer a local school district under a deal that was cut in Salem on what my power was as a building level principal or what the standards were for discipline. So I think you need to recognize the school board is still the employer and needs to do the bargaining. The problem is in terms of controlling that cost, and that's why we're looking at this as an alternative. Also, if you have statewide bargaining, you have potential statewide strikes, and I'm not sure how well you guys will hold up, the legislators elected here in Salem will hold up if our schools are stopped across the state. Take a look at some of what's happening in Washington. And finally, I don't believe there's any state that actually does the collective bargaining for all schools. It's never been mentioned.
Do you have any suggestions, Robert? You mentioned the fact that the local school boards have a tremendous amount of pressure, and we've heard horror stories about, in fact, even from Fern Ridge, I've heard what took place down there. Do you have any way of coming up with an idea of how to eliminate that? I mean, I know it's almost impossible for the school boards because they're local citizens in that community, and the pressure that they get and the mistreatment they get from the unions that are negotiating. Do you have an idea how to overcome anything like that?
I think Mr. Allen talked about his belief that the QEO, Safe Harbor, and his state has created a recognition on the part of the union that they have to be more reasonable. And it isn't just the economic issues, it's going into some other issues we talked about in terms of quality of education things, and it's changed the tenor of bargaining. I'd like to think we could do it through this route. You look at a Fern Ridge where they got a settlement, but it's not over. There's a recall petition out against those board members. Yeah. There may not be board members.
And that's a shame because those people are elected and they serve as volunteers. And that's the pressure on those people. I think it's going to be very difficult to get anybody to run for school board if that kind of a treatment continues.
There is there are some other patterns where the legislature would appropriate the money to districts based on an assumed salary, for instance. And you do that to try to get the districts to pay that salary, and they still have some flexibility locally if they need to go recruit some other people or some special services. But if they do that, then they have to accommodate it to someplace else so they're not spending as much. So there are ways you can encourage it and do it without taking over the bargaining, and that's one of the reasons we brought this bill to your consideration, or encouraged you to introduce it. And I, quite frankly, I didn't think it was going to get this much attention this quickly. But I think it's an emerging issue. That's that classic confrontation, the golden rule. You know, who has the gold makes the rules, and that's kind of what we're feeling in public education now as we've moved to a state-funded system of public schools.
We're starting to get a lot of pressure, a lot from all members to go to statewide because they feel like that's about the only way we can control it. But that's a subject we'll have to address. Ron, do you have some comments?
No. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Mr. Allen, we really appreciate you being here tonight and explaining what you're doing in Wisconsin. Thank you very much for coming.
You have a beautiful day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have one, too. It's very nice. Very nice.
You got one, Paul.
Yeah. thank you all for coming tonight.
Thank you.
We have Mark Toledo, James Sager, Chris. Okay. Maybe the two could come up then. Thank you both for coming tonight.
Thank you. Senator Griffler and members of the committee, for the record, I'm James Sager, an elementary teacher, currently serving as president of the Oregon Education Association. And I know that tonight we need to streamline this a little bit since both 1180 and 1181 are on the docket tonight. I'll just kind of combine my testimony for you, so I'll be only here in front of you once this evening. With me is our general counsel, Mark Toledo. I would first like to give a broad overview of our opposition to these bills, followed by a more detailed analysis by Mark on the concepts presented in Senate Bill 1181 as it relates to the quality education or quality economic offer. In analyzing these bills, we have experienced a strong sense of deja vu. Proposals in the bill ranging from the Successful Schools Program to the Fair Dismissal Law and finally to the Public Employees Collective Bargaining Statute are all too familiar. In 1995, proposals now in Senate Bill 1180 related to the collective bargaining law did not end up in what is now current law following a great deal of negotiation during that legislative session. Likewise, Senate Bill 1180's proposed changes to the Fair Dismissal Law were ones that did not survive a major rewriting of that statute in 1997. Yet, before either management or employees can adequately experience or evaluate the changes made less than 2 years ago, we're back dealing with major changes again. Now, certainly the legislature need not leave in place in perpetuity laws that they pass. However, reviving controversial policy ideas that were examined and rejected so recently seem to divert attention from the broader and more pressing need for the legislature to adequately fund our public schools. OEA views Senate Bill 1180 and 1181 as a complete undermining of the collective bargaining process and due process rights of teachers. Let me highlight our objections to the bills in these two major areas. Under Senate Bill 1180, if at the end of a three-year contract the school district decides not to extend the teacher's contract, the individual has no right to appeal to the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board. No extension will quickly become the preferred method for terminating a teacher because the employee would have no recourse. Changing the law so that all teachers can be non-extended without notice, without cause, and without reason certainly makes it easier to get rid of a few inadequate teachers. But at a time when we are being asked to think outside the box, to try non-traditional programs and approaches, and to help more students achieve, it also makes it far too easy to get rid of a good teacher that someone simply does not like. Teachers as public employees are subject to a great deal of scrutiny and deserve meaningful due process rights. Jeopardizing due process rights of all teachers because of the perceived difficulty and or expense of terminating a few is wrong. Concerns about the performance of a few teachers is sometimes a question of failed supervision, not a question about the cost of getting rid of an inadequate person. Senate Bill 1180 adds to the criteria for teacher evaluation, but, quote, an assessment of the effectiveness of the teacher in producing student achievement gains. Making a teacher's livelihood dependent upon undefined student performance measures, such as one score on one test on one day, is patently unfair, given the many uncontrollable factors that contribute to a student's ability to succeed. Changes addressing reduction in force were painstakingly negotiated last legislative session to protect the ability of the local districts to determine competence and qualification to fill teaching positions in the event of a reduction in force. Senate Bill 1180 deletes most of that negotiated language, thus restricting local control. Subjects of bargaining, formerly considered permissive, would be prohibited. Many of these same subjects, including student discipline, class size, school calendar, and scheduling, are often pivotal in the bargaining process. School safety is not just for adults, but more importantly, for the students. Many of the professional issues bargained into our local contracts were not designed to make our jobs easier, but to help us help students. We want students to be good, deliberative citizens in this state and the world. This prohibition erodes the bargaining process by further limiting its scope and the ability to determine local priorities. School employees, like all other public employees, should have a right to choose their exclusive representative in the bargaining process. School employees' primary responsibilities are to students and their roles in ensuring efficient operation of the schools. We need and should not be denied access to assistance in the bargaining process. Ending status quo bargaining. This would end the practice of providing stability for employees and school districts between bargaining agreements by maintaining normal compensation advancements and paying for increased costs and insurance premiums. This change would likely reduce flexibility on both sides of the table to resolve their differences. It is to the districts, the school employees, and the state's best interest to have bargaining agreements resolved with mutual respect and understanding. These bills are clearly in effect to unlevel the playing field, to provide management with the means to pressure employees into undesirable contracts. Senate Bill 1181, which Mr. Toledo will address, once again singles out teacher bargaining for employers to unilaterally implement a qualified economic offer, thus capping the total compensation package in any year of a collective bargaining contract. With a legislatively set cap, local control over the heart of the public bargaining process for teachers would be completely undermined. There would be no recognition of cost of living needs unique in an area, nor would it allow local communities to establish their own priorities for schools through the bargaining process. OEA feels these bills destroy the local aspect of collective bargaining. They leave the local bargaining process with essentially nothing on the bargaining table. To say that OEA members have been dismayed and disappointed by the introduction of these measures would be to grossly understate the reaction we have heard from school employees around the state. It is the negative emphasis on school employees that they find especially disheartening. As we struggle with mounting workloads and unprecedented pressures in public schools, they view this legislation as a repudiation of their tireless efforts to make schools a springboard for success and safe havens for all students. Instead of further consideration of these bills, we urge you to focus on the need to provide stable and adequate funding so that all schools can be successful. This time I'd like Mr. Salido, if you don't mind, to address the issue.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify this evening on Senate Bills 1180 and Senate Bills 1181. My name is Mark Salido, and I'm testifying on behalf of the membership of the Oregon Education Association, the licensed school teachers, and other school support staff who we represent. My testimony will focus on Senate Bill 1181 and related parts of Senate Bill 1180. The Oregon Education Association strongly opposes both Senate Bills 1180 and 1181. Senate Bill 1181 would allow a school district to propose and unilaterally implement an economic package limiting teachers' salary increases to 2.1% and increases in fringe benefits to 1.7%. After doing so, the school district would no longer have an obligation to bargain over compensation and fringe benefits. This proposal, combined with those elements of Senate Bill 1180 that would make current permissive subjects of bargaining prohibited and unlawful to bargain about, would effectively eliminate collective bargaining for school teachers. The Oregon Education Association is committed to a dialogue with members of the school community on the issue of school funding, including that part of school funding that deals with teacher salaries and benefits. Senate Bill 1181 focuses solely on teacher salaries and benefits without consideration of all the other costs that go into running and operating our schools. These costs include the salaries and benefits of administrators, the salaries and benefits of school support personnel, the administrative cost of running the district, the cost of transportation, the cost of utilities, the cost of special services, the increased costs necessary to meet the needs of disabled students that are rising every day. Senate Bill 1181 is not a solution to the challenges of school funding in our state. It is not a solution to the challenge of providing adequate funds, not only for public education, but for all services the state must provide to its citizens. Senate Bill 1181 and related parts of 1180 will not bring together the interest holders in public education. It will divide and distract all of us from collaboratively working together in deciding how we are going to help our students meet the education reform standards adopted by this legislature just a few years ago. Senate Bill 1181 and related parts of 1180 will cause divisiveness among the stakeholders in public education because it singles out teachers for salary caps and limits on fringe benefits. It will be divisive for the stakeholders in public education because it allows school districts to take away from teachers the collective bargaining rights that all other public employees in the state enjoy. It will be divisive for the stakeholders in public education because it will allow for artificial economic sanctions against teachers at a time when our state and national economy has never been stronger. It will be divisive for the stakeholders in public education because it singles out teachers as the parties who will have to bear the burden of the school funding shift that has occurred because of ballot measures 5 and ballot measure 47. That burden does not just belong to teachers, it belongs to all stakeholders in public education, from individual citizens to the largest corporations. Senate Bill 1181 is unfair to teachers. It is unfair because it effectively eliminates the democratic employment relations system that is enjoyed by all other public employees in the state of Oregon and has been available for school teachers and other public employees since the Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act was adopted in 1973. I want to discuss that the history of our Collective Bargaining Act briefly. In the early 1970s, Governor Tom McCall appointed a task force that determined a comprehensive bill modeled after the National Labor Relations Act would avoid a fragmentary law that granted different rights to different groups of public employees. Senate Bill 1181 would fragment our public employees' collective bargaining law by eliminating or allowing for the elimination of teachers' rights in collective bargaining. So legislative history shows that the Oregon School Board Association was strongly opposed to the act when it was first adopted and insisted that teachers be excluded from the law altogether. For those of us in the community of public education, Senate Bill 1181 is a case of deja vu. The OEA sees no value in revisiting the debate about the rights of school teachers to have the same collective bargaining rights as other public employees. This debate will not and does not advance the interests of public education. This debate does not and will not advance a collaborative working relationship between school teachers and school boards. There are far greater challenges for our school communities and for our legislature and governor to address. The OEA is anxious to work with the public school community, the governor, and the legislature to find an adequate and stable source of school funding. For 26 years, the Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act has provided a democratic process for employers and employees to discuss and bargain terms and conditions of employment that are important to and have meaning for both parties. We ask you, what problem would Senate Bill 1181 fix? If the legislature believes that levels for school funding are excessive, then why pull out one component of the school district budget, that being school teacher salaries and compensation, and place a cap on the salaries and benefits of teachers only and not consider other school district costs? The current Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act has matured, and the parties who have participated in collective bargaining have matured along with the Act. Senate Bill 1181 would allow school districts who choose to use it to reverse much of the progress that has been made in collective bargaining to the experience that we in Oregon have. As collective bargaining in the state has matured, more and more collaborative bargaining has taken place. The statistics and information that the Oregon School Board Association has will verify that. School employers who choose to use the qualified economic offer will foreclose the opportunity for parties to mutually negotiate and develop creative and mutually agreed-upon solutions involving compensation and other employment concerns. At a time when we face teacher shortages, a cap on school teacher salaries and benefits will discourage the best and brightest who we want to teach our children from entering and remaining in the teaching profession. Placing an artificial cap on school teacher salary and benefits is totally contrary to the free market system that truly dictates what happens from one school district to another. The Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act was well thought out and has worked well in Oregon. In 1973, when the legislature adopted the act, it adopted the following policy statement. Recognition by public employers of the right of public employees to organize and full acceptance of the principle and procedure of collective negotiation between the public employers and public employee organizations can alleviate various forms of strife and unrest. Experience in the private and public sectors of our economy has proved that unresolved disputes in the public service are injurious to the public, the governmental agencies, and public employees. Experience in private and public employment has also proved that protection by law of the right of employees to organize and negotiate collectively safeguards employees and the public from injury, impairment, and interruptions of necessary services, and removes certain recognized sources of strife and unrest by encouraging practices fundamental to the peaceful adjustment of disputes arising out of differences as to wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment. The state has a basic obligation to protect the public by attempting to assure the orderly and uninterrupted operations and functions of government. The statistics that you can get from the State Employment Relations Board will indicate that in the first 20 years of the Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act, of more than 4,200 contracts negotiated, only 34 in all sectors, not just public education, result in strikes. That's 1% over that 20-year period. Our act does work and is working. Senate Bill 1181 will allow school districts to eliminate the equality of bargaining power between school teachers and their employers. It will not, however, eliminate differences over terms and conditions of employment. It will not eliminate litigation over bargaining. It will create lots of work for lawyers and accountants. The experience in Wisconsin has proven that to be true. A quick review of litigation before the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission reveals that litigation in 1998 over whether the Dodson School District had made a qualified economic offer. There was litigation in the Shorewood School District in Wisconsin in 1997 over alleged unlawful implementation of a qualified economic offer. There was litigation in at least two school districts in 1995 in Wisconsin as to whether layoff and recall was an economic issue under the qualified economic offer statute. Mr. Allen referred to, I believe, a sick-out, a broad sick-out that occurred in Wisconsin despite the fact that strikes were unlawful in that state. There have been other matters and instances of labor unrest in Wisconsin involving work to the rule and those sorts of issues. Mr. Dudley talked about the power the school board lack and the power that the Oregon Education Association has. The only power our members get comes from the public and public support for their issues and bargaining. The only power that a school board can get can come from the public. It does not come from Jim Sager sitting as president of the Oregon Education Association. It does not come from Joanne Waller, the executive director in Tigard. It does not come from me. It comes from the public. School boards have that same access to that power that our member does. It's part of the democratic process. Democracy is not efficient, and it is not easy. In collective bargaining in Oregon, both in schools and other areas, there has been robust public debate over issues concerning terms and conditions of employment. Our First Amendment contemplates that there will be robust public debate over all of these issues. Again, that is not always easy. Democracy sometimes is difficult. The Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act has guaranteed that democratic principles on which our government was founded will be followed in the workplace. OEA asks that you not revisit the fight of 26 years ago over collective bargaining for teachers. At a time when adequate and stable school funding is the biggest challenge, at a time when higher standards of student achievement are the challenge, a proposal to eliminate bargaining rights for school teachers can only distract our public school community from its mission to teach, to protect, and to nourish the learning environment for our children. With all due respect, we urge you not to support Senate Bill 1181. I'm a father of three children, two who are in our public education system. I assume that all of you or many of you have had children or know children who are in that system. If you go and spend a day in our public school classes, if you spend half a day in our public school classes with 28 fourth graders, with 35 eighth graders, with however many there might be, you will have no disbelief that $42,000 a year for an individual who has worked 20, 25, or 30 years as a teacher is not enough to pay a school teacher. I value what they do more than any other profession, including lawyers, in terms of what they are doing for our children. They are the most important people in the lives of our children, and they deserve the highest compensation that can be offered for them. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify tonight.
Okay, any questions? Okay, thank you both for testifying. See, Mary, you want to come up if you have a message. You want to? You're going to, on 1180? Okay. Is Chris, is Bobby gone? Okay. Is it here? They want to come up on 1181? 1180, I guess, would you? Should we hear the next one, children? Okay. 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 You want to talk on 1180? Or do that thing? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Chris Dudley, Executive Director of the Oregon School Board Association, 1201 Court Street, Northeast, Salem, Oregon. Thank you for letting us appear on this bill. I thought the hearing was on 1180 only. 1181 only. Actually, we have our handed out testimony goes through this bill section by section, but there's really five things we want to talk about, and we'll do that briefly.
Okay.
One is the first section allows a delegation of school board authority to a school administrator for certain hiring, firing, etc. One, we think that already you can only do that. Two, if you put it in the law like this, it ought to be prohibited subject to bargaining, so we don't end up getting hammered at the bargaining table about who decides whether teachers are continuing employment in the district or not.
Second major issue is it does not allow contract non-extensions to be appealed. And when we, that's how we started out with 650, and it's not how we ended up with 880 last session. This essentially moves the teacher employment status to the same thing we now have to administer. Yeah, kind of those changes in section, most of them in section 8. Section 9 repeals or abolishes the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board and substitutes a hearing officer process for that. And it's my understanding that this legislature is going to create a professional panel of hearings officers, and those people will be used to do the hearings on a teacher dismissal. We believe, however, that this bill goes one step too far, which is the hearings officer makes the decision rather than a recommended order and finding it back to the board. We think you ought to amend it so that the hearings officer conducts the hearings, gets the all the information and facts together, prepares a finding of facts and a recommended order, submits that to the school board, and then the school board can decide whether this is consensus, and it would be appealed to the Court of Appeals. And fourth, the provisions on collective bargaining, Section 13, basically making certain prohibitions of bargaining are now permissive. One of the issues in here is whether the state is going to have a uniform process for dismissal of teachers. And if you are, then you need to make some adjustments, an additional adjustment in this proposal, but some adjustments to say you're not going to bargain alternative processes. There is going to be a process the state recognizes. And that's part of what the changes in the collective bargaining law in Section 13 do. And then Section 15, this section is probably the most important section to us. That's the section that eliminates the requirement that employees get their annual set pay increase while new contracts are being negotiated. In essence, under the current situation, because of a 2-to-1 decision by the Employment Relations Board several years ago, if you have step increases and increases in the or set contributions to like full pay for fringe benefits, some employees in some situations get that raise by sitting on their hands rather than concluding bargaining. And in a situation now where we're the degree to which we're relying on the income tax for the financial structure for schools, the first time there's a hiccup in the economy, there's probably going to be a special session to cut support for public schools. In a situation like that, it doesn't seem that it doesn't seem like the Herb Board contemplated that kind of a situation when they created the current status quo provisions. So in effect, what we're asking for is a change in the statute, and this, we're asking you to support this proposed change in statute, which says you don't get the raise, and you don't get the adjustment in fringe benefits unless you bargain for an agreement. So for those are really the four major things in the proposed amendments to current law that are in Senate Bill 1180.
Any questions? Ron, do you have any comments?
No, it's
good. Okay. A good thank you both for coming.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Mary, do you want to come up next? Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Senator Dirfler and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Bryant, and I come to you representing myself. Before I was connected with Senator Bryant as his legislative assistant, I was a teacher in the public schools of Oregon for 15 years. I have a bachelor's in education and a master's in educational administration. I come to this body with a rather unique viewpoint, that being that I feel I do understand somewhat what it's like to be in a classroom and face the decisions and the pressures that teachers have on them every day. I also know the fear in the teachers here and around the state as they feel the anticipation of another bill that would affect them both personally and professionally. The other side of me is the fact that I've been in this building for three sessions. And I've listened to the concerns of people who are demanding accountability, financial accountability in education. I've talked to public employees around the state who have not had the benefit of the type of increases in salary and in benefits that our teachers have. I've listened to elderly and disabled people whose lives will be directly affected if we fund education at the level that advocates for education are feeling that they need to be funded right now. It's a very delicate balance that you have to reach. But I think what I would like to say is we have to think of the dignity of all the people involved and find a way that that is not lost in the process. As to Senate Bill 1180, I have some things that I like about it, and I have some things that I don't like about it. And I'll just go quickly through them. There are many sections of the bill that I agree that are good for education. I like the super teacher program. I see problems in requiring a replication of the best practices of some of the best teachers. All teachers have different styles of teaching as we have different styles of learning. And if you say that you have to replicate what is going on with best teachers, it might work for some teachers, it might not work for others. And all of you in the room, all of you on the panel, have had high school and middle school teachers and maybe grade school teachers that are tough cookies. They toe the line and they say, you're going to do this, you do it then, and you love them and you get a lot of learning done. And you also have teachers that are free thinkers. They encourage kids to make their own decisions and still a lot of learning goes on. So I would be careful in saying that there is only one way to do things. And you can trust me, teachers will look at other teachers and see the successes and adapt them. That's important. Let them see what good teachers do, but don't require that they emulate A or B. In regard to the at-risk pilot school idea, I don't want to see you limit that to just 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th graders. With the information that we're getting now on designating or targeting high-risk kids, we can go all the way back to prenatal and target those kids. So I'd like to see some sort of use of this at-risk program for kids under that age, not just beginning in the middle school through 9th grade. I also question in that particular section the requirements that are for a year-round program in 8 hours. I don't know what the people of the committee made that decision, but I think that needs to be based on some solid research rather than what sounds good, and I'm not sure what the background was on that. I like the change from 2 years to 3 years in enrolling contracts. I think that'll give administrators and teachers and districts a chance to get used to the loan contract and not having tenure. And I think that that is something that would be very good to change. Now my big concern area is Section 21 of the bill. And that has to do with implementing the evaluation process that includes an assessment of the effectiveness of teachers in producing student achievement gains. I disagree with this because requiring what I believe is going to be used are the test scores that we are receiving on the kits. And currently, it is very, very difficult to evaluate a teacher's effectiveness by the test scores that the kids receive. I'm not going to go into the little ditty I have in here about what happened to me when I was teaching with another teen teacher. You can read that at your leisure. But I do have great concerns about the testing procedures that we're using now in Oregon under the Educational Act of the 21st Century. At this time, that is a moving target. We are currently throwing out one of the fifth grade math tests this year because it's so difficult, no one can pass it. These tests are not they're written by teachers and administrators. They're not written by, God bless them, but they're not written by people who are professional test writers. And we have, they're not put in a way that, that is coordinated. They don't teach the test each year, as you know. It's third grade, fifth grade, eighth grade, and tenth grade. So you're not talking about, if you use that criteria, you're not talking about a yearly type of thing. If you take third grade and then have a nationally normed test in fourth grade, if you're using the third grade assessment, 21st assessment, you can't compare those. Until you have something that is comparable, and, or some kind of a test you can give the kids in September and test them again in June to see what kind of gains they've made, I don't think you can use this to fairly assess whether teachers are being effective or not. It is not fair. I believe that it's still important, and you should consider to keep things like unannounced visits to the classroom, direct supervision, evaluation by school administrators who know their teachers, and they know their faculty and how it works together. And get, if best possible alternative is to have this language optional, especially in Section 21. So I'd be glad to answer any questions if you have any.
Questions for me?
I have been joined by Senator Bryant.
Is that who it is?
On the right hand.
Okay. We really appreciate your input and stuff.
Okay.
Thank you for coming. Okay, we have Sandy Ellis, Chris Nelson, and Ryan Kitcher. We appreciate all three of you coming tonight. So thank you very much for coming to testify and help us understand what's the issue here.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Sandy Ellis. My address is 1400 Salem Avenue, Southeast in Albany, Oregon. I'm here this evening to provide you with testimony from School Board Chairman Forrest Reed, School Board Member Frank Bricker, and School Board Member Don Bacher from the Albany School Board. For the record, we are members of the Greater Albany Public School Board and have all been members of an Albany School District bargaining team. The Albany School District is extremely proud of the relationship that exists between its administration and the certified and classified associations. It may be hard to believe, but there is a great deal of cooperation and trust between the Albany District and its teaching and support staff. This cooperation and trust is evidenced by the way we have developed our collaborative bargaining process. Over the last 12 years, all of our contracts have been bargained this way. Teams from both sides have come together in a spirit of trust to find answers for the questions affecting all of us. 90% of those questions have had nothing to do with salaries or benefits. The majority of the 90% didn't even result in new or modified contract language. There are simply items that were a concern that needed to be addressed with each side being heard. As we look at some of the language in Senate Bill 1180, we see our ability to continue with our collaborative process put in jeopardy. We see us losing the ability to talk about the questions that affect all of us because now we will be legislated as to what we can and cannot discuss. Our bargaining agenda will be predetermined. The open forum we have used successfully these 12 years will become a thing of the past. We see Senate Bill 1181 eliminating the flexibility we now have in relation to our bargaining process. Currently, there is a great deal of open discussion around money-related items. With our current system, the bargaining association may, for example, feel there are financial items of more consequence than a major raise in the salary base. For that reason, they are willing to give in that area to gain in another. As we understand it, the language of Senate Bill 1181 would take away this flexibility. No longer would we be able to
talk outside the box of salary and benefits, no longer would either side be able to look at other options. This year, the Albany School District bargained a 3-year certified contract and a 2-year classified contract. Both of those contracts were each negotiated in 6 days of bargaining. I would guess that that's unheard of in Oregon and in most of the United States as well. We've been able to come to that because we have developed a high level of trust and cooperation in our district and because we currently have the flexibility to talk about all the issues, including the district's financial package. Senate Bills 1180 and 1181 would take away our bargaining flexibility. They would eliminate the forum for dealing with all the issues and significantly hamper the way a financial package is developed and settled. Please consider these implications as you deliberate on Senate Bills 1180 and 1181. And Mr. Bacher and Mr. Bricker and Chairman Reed have signed the testimony for you.
Okay. Ms. Ellis, I think you heard in the testimony that the 1181 would be an optional thing that the school board could choose or not choose.
Yes, I heard so that today.
That would not take away your ability to continue on your present program, I don't believe.
Well, I didn't write this testimony for these three gentlemen. They had a copy of the piece of legislation, and they created their own testimony. And we're disappointed that they're unable to come this evening and ask me to deliver it for them. I will be happy to deliver your message back to them.
Would you agree with me that since it is optional, that you'd be able to continue the present program?
As I understand it, that's what I've heard you say this evening in terms of the salary in 1181. I believe there's a large number of restrictions in 1180 in terms of what topics would be allowed to be bargained and which ones you would be labeling prohibitive. And I think that was a major concern of these three board members who have had extensive experience in bargaining with their associations, that that there's such a flexibility and interchangeable program when you bargain between non-economic and economic issues that they think that this would...
Could you tell me, one of the complaints we get most of all as legislators is the fact that the students don't have current books. And Albany, do you have very current books in your system?
Well, as far as I know, we do. I suppose Ms. Nelson here to my left is a teacher in Albany, and she might be able to respond better to that. I work for the Oregon Education Association, which I think speaks well to our relationship with the school board in Albany that they would ask, these three school board members would ask that I deliver their testimony to you. I think that in all districts, there's always that struggle between how the money is going to be spent and how much of it is going to be spent in terms of salaries and benefits and personnel, which are pretty critical to the students.
When you bargain collaboratively like you're speaking about, is that something that's discussed and those things are taken care of in the bargaining process?
The board, as I understand it, usually sets a goal of only a certain percentage of their salary being a certain percentage of their budget being spent on salary and benefits, and they apply that to administrative classified, confidential, and certified personnel, and they pretty much have stuck to that percentage.
I think if the system you're speaking about was used probably throughout the state with other school districts, maybe we wouldn't be here talking about this tonight.
That very well could be possible, but I've been involved in this process with the Albany School District as a representative for both the certified and classified employees for 9 years now. And I guess I can tell you that it works. We've been very successful with it. And there's been a lot of labor rest and labor peace in Albany. Both sides have to want to do it. Both sides have to build honesty and trust in a relationship with each other. And if you can start there, then any district in the state can have the same relationship that we have.
It's certainly not happening throughout the state.
Yeah, there needs to be the desire to have it, both from the school board's perspective as well as the association's perspective. The school board, they're the leader in the district, and if they could set the example, I bet I could almost guarantee that every teacher association and classified association would love to follow that example.
Why do you think that doesn't happen? Why do you have such an adversarial relationship between school boards and teachers?
I think that that the relationship needs to go beyond the bargaining table. So when you relate to each other on a day-to-day basis and you're solving problems on a daily basis, that trust and respect exists. It can't just be at the bargaining table and then you walk away and treat each other poorly. That respect has to continue throughout the contract, the life of the contract, not just at the bargaining table. And if you can do that, and you know, Senator, it's hard. I'm not telling you that it's not hard. It is hard to do it. But as Ms. Nelson will testify, there was a crisis in Albany, and everybody got together after that crisis and said, we have to do this differently. And that's what prompted the relationship to begin.
Okay, questions? Anybody? Okay.
Chairman, good evening, Senators. My name is Chris Nelson. I live at 2018 Northwest Fairbank Place in Albany, Oregon. I teach physical education at South Albany High School. And I've taught in the district for about 23 years. Also, currently I serve as president of the Greater Albany Education Association. About half of my life in teaching in Albany has been an unrest and confrontational style of bargaining. The other half of my life has been in relative peace, as Andy Ellis is pointing out to you. Now, in 1976, I was hired, and before I ever had my first paycheck, my colleagues grabbed me and said, we need to go pick up the district office. And we were turning in our keys and listening to the radio to find out if we'd go to work. We did this every time we bargained. In 1987, GAEA went on strike in Albany. It only lasted a few hours, but it was a result of an unwillingness to approach our problems in a manner that showed respect and understanding. After the strike, the associations, and that includes both teachers and classified, the school board, and the community, we did have a good cross-section of the community involved in this, said we need to do this differently. There needs to be a better way of bargaining that doesn't bring about such animosity. We worked very hard to discover that way, and we have. And now we feel that these two bills, 1180 and 1181, are taking our better way of doing things away from us. Regardless of what kind of relationship you're in, it takes work. And if you want to have a positive one, I teach that to my teenagers all the time when we have bickering going on out on the field. For the last 12 years in Albany, board and the association have worked very hard, and we've built a positive relationship. And it has been hard work, and it is rocky sometimes. This relationship begins at the bargaining table. It is here that we discuss the issues that are most important to both parties. We bring our problems to the table, as says the school board, and together we brainstorm and work out solutions. We have pieces of paper all over the walls, and we've come up with many, many ideas, some not so good, some pretty good. This relationship continues after ratification. If other issues or problems come up during the duration of the contract, we reach resolutions through letters of understanding that are either incorporated into the contract when it opens or have ending dates on them. This process becomes cyclical, and most importantly, it gets issues handled and problems solved, and therefore we have a better place for our students. Our relationship and collective bargaining has made this possible. Senate Bills 1180 and 1181 threaten our peace in Albany. First of all, Senate Bill 1180 gag the parties at the bargaining table so that problems cannot be resolved. We just finished bargaining a contract with the district, and the classified did also. We finished in 6 days. We bargained for 75 hours. Four of the issues that the district brought to the table were permissive. Four problems of the districts under this bill would go unresolved. Eight of the association's issues brought to the table were permissive. Eight problems of the associations under your bill would go unresolved. What's the point? It seems pretty obvious that when problems go unresolved, unrest begins. When unrest begins and morale is low, the relationship suffers. When the relationship suffers, so are the students suffer. And I'm here to tell you that in the end, in the long run, it's our students you're hurting with this Senate Bill 1180. Second, I understand that 1180 eliminates our rights to select our exclusive representative. DAEA is a member of the Mid-Valley Bargaining Council. It was formed in the early 80s. MVDC is our bargaining agent. Corvallis, Albany are the two largest locals of those of that association. The other locals are much smaller in size. The purpose of the council is to help the smaller locals. The smaller locals were often facing district-hired professional attorneys by themselves. Through the council, we could provide assistance to them. This council is another party in this relationship that we have with our district. For as long as we have been resolving our problems in the collaborative style, so have we been represented by this Mid-Valley Bargaining Council. School employees, like all other public employees, should have the right to choose their exclusive representative in the bargaining process. Being a member of the bargaining council has not hindered in any way our collaborative efforts. Third, the provision you have regarding the change in status quo can also cause major labor strife. Status quo provides both the school board and association some stability until the contract is settled. Oftentimes, bargaining is not settled when the contract expires. Sometimes, due to folks' calendars, or the numbers of issues that need resolution, or other unavoidable matters, such as the contract expires and you're simply not finished. What should happen then? The old contract is followed until the new one is agreed upon. Making exceptions to rules, as you are doing, is going to cause labor strife, and it's also going to cause an imbalance in the process. When you tip the scales like this in favor of management, resentment follows and relationships are strained. Status quo keeps the playing field even so that both parties will want to finish with no one feeling like a loser. When we bargained our contract this year, we spent 75 hours at the bargaining table in 6 days. Maybe two or three of those hours were spent on salary and insurance. The important issues were other than financial. We have a huge workload issue in Albany, and it's directly related to the ed reform law and the special ed requirements. We actually had issues that took precedence over money. We were willing to take less of a raise than we thought we should have, which was helping the district with one of their problems in exchange for the district dealing with some of our problems. Now, I'm here to tell you that if you cap what the district can spend on salary and insurance, and we each time we bargain, we'll go and meet that cap. We agreed this year on a 1.56 increase so that other dollars could be spent to help with ed reform and special education costs. We could do this because we knew if the cost of living goes up, we'd have the opportunity to bargain some makeup costs next time. Senate Bill 1181 would prohibit us from doing this. Therefore, the flexibility the district needed from the association and the understanding the association needed from the district would not be possible. In conclusion, I'm going to take this just a little bit different direction. I would like to tell you about a young teacher that I met over spring break when we were up here in Salem. She's from Southern Oregon. She's been teaching for 5 years. She just finished listening to a briefing on these two bills, and her reply was, "Why would I stay in teaching?" She said she has friends that have the same level of education she has who went to work in private sector and after 5 years are making $60,000 to $100,000 a year. Why, she wondered, with legislation like this, would she stay in the classroom? My point in telling you is that in eventuality, no one of top quality is going to want to go into education. Some of us may not even want to stay there. Legislation like this is going to have long-term effects that aren't even imagined. If this passes and goes into effect, there might be some short-term satisfaction that you might that you did whatever you wanted to do here. But in the long run, as you diminish the teaching profession, young, bright students will select other careers, and their successors will sit around and wonder why. And I'm sitting next to a man who's going to tell you his perspective on that. Thank you.
Any questions, Ms. Wilson? Just a couple of comments. You talked about status quo, and yet you already negotiated 6 days. I don't think status quo probably would affect you a great deal if you bargain those things out very quickly.
We have bargained with in this manner, and we have bargained past the expiration date of contracts. Collaborative bargaining isn't easy sometimes, and it oftentimes takes longer than traditional bargaining. This This year, this bargaining was the first time that we set a goal to finish a lot faster, and we met that goal, and I think everyone was satisfied with the results.
The other comment is the same comment made earlier. This is an optional thing, so I don't think 1181 would affect you. I don't think you'd even choose to go that way. What I'd point out, I think the best thing for us to do is to get rid of all the school boards and get rid of all the OAs and put you guys in charge of both of them, because I think we figured out a way to do it.
We'd be happy to any district who would like us to come and share our experiences with them and tell them how we can do it.
Okay.
Go ahead. I have a couple questions or comments. One comment, actually we've heard a couple of times in the testimony about the education reform in kind of alluding to the cost of that and that being part of the negotiations, and that it is driving some costs. I wonder what teachers would... In fact, I actually had a superintendent say to me that, you know, pretty soon it's going to be so costly that we might as well just go back to the old way. And I'm wondering if you have any comment on sort of just going back to the old way.
I want to pay you for this.
Yeah.
No, as a PE teacher, I'm not dramatically affected by the ed reform law. But I watch my colleagues, the English department, they're just dragging because they're working on work samples and they're testing and they're testing and they're testing and they're adopting a curriculum to try to meet these tests and they're overworked. And I see the results in the kids. They were just wired last week after spending 2 weeks of testing. And the social studies test, 2 days of sophomores in a cafeteria taking social studies tests was an interesting phenomenon. So I think there are some problems with the ed reform law. I don't know if it's all bad, but it needs a lot of work.
Last year, I took a break from my regular special ed assignment and taught second grade, where I was assigned 20... Ryan Keeser. I'm representing the newer teachers in Oregon. I'm teaching the Reynolds School District in Troutdale. In calculating out what I had to spend as my first year having to meet those benchmarks with the ed reform, with 28 second graders in my district, which continues to raise the standard the state sets, I had to have 2 writing samples, 1 speaking sample, 3 math, and 1 reading sample. Each of those had to be graded and evaluated by myself, had to have a cover sheet put on each of those, and then all of those put together with an additional cover sheet recording all of those scores, and then that prepared with the goal sheet and presented at the conference. To accomplish that for 28 students, it took me nearly 60 hours, additional work, outside of what I was contracted to pay for, being paid for, to get all that done. On top of my planning for my curriculum, on top of preparing my students for the end of the year, it was incredibly hard. As a new teacher, not having worked really hard in 4 years of university to finish my teaching certificate and coming to a state in a district where I was not prepared from my formal training for this type of ed reform sounded extremely overwhelming and very discouraging, with little training available to teach me on how to do that more efficiently. And so, you know, it is going to be much costly in the future.
Okay. And then I have another. I just have a comment about, Ms. Reynolds, you commented in your testimony about after the briefing on these 2 bills. And I have some letters in my file from teachers who apparently have been briefed on these bills. And either they've been briefed erroneously and don't understand what these bills are doing, I think that's what's happening. If they're being told something that really isn't the case in these bills, I guess it looks like to the teachers that have written me that, you know, they're in jeopardy of losing salary and benefits, to the degree where they want to leave the profession. And I don't think what we're doing here, based upon the statistics that we were given by the other gentleman about the rate of increase, that is that detrimental.
I pointed out to you, most of the conversation at the bargaining table in Albany was not about money. It was about our workload.
I'd like to make also a comment. You mentioned that the training you got in university didn't really prepare you for education, for the teaching.
To clarify, Senator Drickler, it didn't prepare me. My university was in Washington State, graduated in 93, and I'm an Oregon resident, returned here to begin teaching, unaware of what was awaiting me in terms of that ed reform and the need for additional portfolios. That was not included in my training. As a matter of fact, the last 2 years in the building that I'm assigned now, we've had a team of student teachers attending Portland State University who tracked with us for a full year and completed their training with us. In lunchroom conversations with them, I pulled them aside to say, hey, you know, are they now training you on how to meet this ed reform? Are they teaching you on how to score work samples and how to prepare portfolios? Not one of them said yes. And they'll all be walking into the workforce this fall facing the same thing I faced, not being prepared and having this tremendous burden in front of them, and it's extremely discouraging. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our colleagues are throwing their hands up because they're getting as frustrated as we are. And these people who, you know, are 15, 20, 25 years in the profession.
Okay. Then I guess you just picked up on what Ms. Nelson said, comment about, I mean, we're going to get some satisfaction out of trying to destroy the school system. And I would assure you that's not our intent. We are just as interested and dedicated to make schools look better as you are. So to say that we're not interested in or trying to hurt schools is really not our purpose. I just want to point that out to you.
Senator, can I just point out one piece that I look at, just the very first page of the bill, and it talked about super teachers. And to me, that's threatening. To me, that's, you're going to judge my teaching based on how my kids perform, and I can tell you, you come look at some of the kids that I teach. It's a little bit scary to have that kind of it feels like a threat to me.
Okay.
It's just a feeling.
Sure.
And I think that's where the teaching
you express that, sure. In your case.
I think that's partly where we come from, just looking at the very first page of the bill.
Okay.
Actually, I just want to comment on that. I saw it as a reward. And, I mean, that somebody is rewarded for a good job done, I don't understand why that's a threat.
I have teachers in my family. My mother's one, and my two sisters are, so.
When I see that we have successful schools and we have some that aren't so successful, I wish that we would reward the unsuccessful schools to help push them along.
Absolutely. I'm sorry, I need to cheer on.
The way that reward system is that the successful ones, 25% of them that get the highest scores, that's how it was set up, get rewarded. The other 25% that improves their score, so we are covering 50% of the schools, one the lowest that improved the most, and one that got the highest scores, and then we're rewarding teachers who do an excellent job. To me, I don't understand why that would be a negative thing to reward people for doing a good job. So often we use sticks, and this seemed like a carrot. And so it's kind of a surprise to see that it's
different perspective.
Yeah.
Do you have any other comments today?
A brief testimony to the commission. My name is Ryan Caesar, and I am here representing the newer generation of Oregon teachers. For the last 4 years, I've taught in Oregon public schools as a special ed teacher of 3rd, 4th, and 5th grade emotionally disturbed children. As mentioned, taking a year off last year for my own time, I didn't teach 2nd graders. In the 4 years I've been teaching, I've seen a sizable increase in student performance standards, teacher workload, and class sizes, while at the same time have seen the city decline in school funding. Other legislation has attacked teachers' retirements, eroded our bargaining rights, and put an end to teacher tenure, all of which has made me question why I would want to continue to stay in the profession of teaching in Oregon public schools. One of the pieces of Senate Bill 1180, which I find very objectionable, is the part that my professional evaluation may go on to include my effectiveness as a teacher being compared to the achievement gains my students make. I feel that making my livelihood dependent upon my students' performance is unfair. As I mentioned, I'm a special education teacher, and the students who I teach do not possess adequate social skills to remain in their regular classroom. I run a behavior classroom for the entire district. All six elementary schools filter those third and fourth, fifth graders to me. They still are required to take the state testing, and in addition, a lot of these kids live in poverty. They lack what would be considered basic needs. They're surrounded by countless negative influences such as domestic violence, sexualization, physical and emotional neglect, chemical abuse, just to name a few. The chaos of their home life trickles, if not at times, definitely floods into my classroom and the surrounding classrooms. I'm willing to work hard to educate these children, helping them to live up to our ed reform standards. But holding me to a test score is not appropriate. Should this bill pass, there is no guarantee that my work would not be scrutinized when my students do not produce scores that are, in the eyes of my evaluators, satisfactory. I see that as unfair. Seeing as how the QEO piece has been, I feel, adequately addressed, I think the piece there that bothered me the most was that, again, recognizing that my future earning power could be eroded, and the amount of time I have to put in, again, meeting these standards, meeting the ed reform, goes beyond even what my contract hours are. And should the district elect to use that, as already been pointed out, I'll keep that piece of my testimony out, because that's what I'm satisfied with. At the same time, though, that this type of legislation is going on, districts like my own are forming positive partnerships between administration and teachers by jointly offering professional standards that drive my evaluation and any plan of assistance that may be developed. I know that, personally, my district model has already been looked at by other districts in this state, and we have seen the authoring team of both teachers and administrators visit other states in this region to present the theory and model of such a program to district administration and teaching staff. Before we even allowed to see the outcomes of these types of proactive partnerships between districts and their teachers, we may be giving school boards the firepower to unfairly dismiss teachers. This would include teachers who are new hires to school districts and are at the end of their probationary years. I'm talking here about the denial of non-extensions within Senate Bill 1180. Over the past year and a half, I've had the opportunity to work with teachers in and around the state who are new to teaching and new to Oregon. And when we gather together, it no longer surprises me to learn that many of the new faces that I've met will be absent in the years to come because they're getting out of teaching. They're moving on to find work in different fields or going back to school to get more education in different professions. And a lot of it is because of many of the hoops that Oregon teachers are now required to jump through. From personal experience, I have decided after a year and a half of debate to take a leave of absence after the school year. This summer, I'm going to go to work for a nonprofit organization training teachers around the country to more effectively teach spelling, reading, and writing to students. This nonprofit organization has put a salary on the table, which is more than my current public employer is able to do, but it's taken me a year and a half to get here because I didn't want to leave the classroom. I'm a highly trained, talented, and effective teacher. I'm respected by my peers and my students. I volunteer for 20 hours some weeks, volunteering high school English after hours in the evening, and also teaching teachers how to more effectively teach English language arts. And I willingly do this because I love the profession. It's in my blood. It's in my mother, my aunt, and all three of my aunts are all in education. And I'm motivated to continue to be an effective teacher, but I'm not motivated to continue teaching in a state where I feel that my elected officials are sending me a loud and clear message that my hard work is not appreciated and my professionalism is not being recognized. I'm not worried only about new teachers walking into this profession blind to what awaits them, but all teachers in Oregon. With attrition rates on the rise, we need to promote teaching in Oregon. If we want our children to end up as happy, balanced, healthy young men and women, we have to have a teaching force that's willing to work hard to ensure that they can meet all the standards and all the expectations put in front of them. Both of these bills I find discouraging and an attack on teaching which is unnecessary. I hope that you show that you care about teachers in Oregon, and in doing so, show that you care about our Oregon children. I hope that both of these bills die in committee. I urge you to vote no.
Right. Okay. Go ahead.
My name is Neil Bryant, and I'm a senator from Central Oregon, and earlier one of the people testifying was my wife, who is a teacher. And she hasn't taught the last 4 years because she's been my legislative assistant. But her friends, some of my friends are teachers. I'm an attorney for a school district. Sam Gerfler's wife was a teacher. His daughter is still a teacher, taught almost 30 years. And
in my community, I don't think anyone can dispute that I've always supported education. My children went through the Ben Klein School District, so on and so forth. But here's our dilemma. Senator Cutshove and I serve on the Ways and Means Committee, and in fact she chairs the Subcommittee on Human Resources. And beginning in 1990, we changed the way we finance school education in the state, where at that time 71% of the money came from local property taxes, but after Measure 5, and we only supplied 29% then, this last biennium we provided through the State General Fund 70% of funding. This biennium will probably increase closer to 80%. And yet we don't control how the dollars are spent and can't control the spending level. And that's our policy problem and why I co-sponsor the 1181. If you have another idea of how to do that, and Senator Gerfer and I in the past have tried to stay away from statewide collective bargaining and encourage local collective bargaining, but when we're providing them by we, I mean the state of Oregon, the legislature, 80% of the funding, and don't control the spending, we don't do that for any other branch of government. And it all comes out of the general fund, so that means that the dollars we give to education, there's less money for the Oregon Health Plan, or less money for Oregon State Police, and we have to make those balancing decisions every day, and it has to be a very, very broad idea. So those are what we're facing, and our frustration is not that we don't want to have well-paid, happy, satisfied teachers, but how do we have control of the spending? Because if we don't, then we don't have enough money for the other programs. And you could say, well, raise taxes, that's very difficult to do. And Oregon has a very high income tax right now. Of course, we have no sales tax, which is sales 8 times. But my challenge to the three of you and anyone else that is critical of the Senate Bill 1180, come up with a way, a system, where we can have, as a legislature, some control of spending. And the nice feature about the Wisconsin plan is that every 2 years you can come in and argue about what the percentage increase per year should be. 3.8 is more than we're giving as far as an increase in salary and benefits for any other state employee that I can think of. So from our perspective on what we do with other state agencies and other budgets, it's generous. And I'm not sure 3.8 is the right percentage, but we introduced a bill and intended to create discussion, which we've certainly done with these two bills. But if right now, for instance, the other unions in the state, OPU and AFSCME, you know, feel that they're getting killed in the way that we're doing our budgeting because we don't control the spending on K-12. And again, that's because of through the initiative process, the change in the way we finance schools. So I'm open to other ideas, but it's something that we need to address. And Senator Gerfer and I looked around the country, and because Wisconsin had 5 years of experience with this and it seemed to work, we just copied that, and that's our attempt. But I said, if you have another idea, we're more than willing to listen to it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bryant, I taught school in Bend, Oregon for 13 years before I moved over to the Valley, and also cut my bargaining teeth at the bargaining table in Bend. And I've been bargaining at different bargaining tables now for the last 20 years. There's got to be a reason for both parties to want to settle. It's making it comfortable for one side by giving them this percentage to fall back on is making it too comfortable, and the need for settlement has gone away. You provide 70 to 75% now because of ballot measure 5 and other initiatives to schools. You have a formula. You distribute the money to the school. Every community is different. Beaverton is different than Hillsboro, is different from Springfield, is different from Eugene. And those communities elect local school boards to reflect
the community's needs and desires as to what their schools are going to offer their children in that community. And if you have a formula here at the state that distributes that money, and then the communities use that money to reflect the community desires, Ms. Senator Dirtler said, local control is important. And that relationship between the school board, who represents the community, and their teaching staff and their other school employees and their administrators, that relationship has to be forged. And if you put something into effect like 1181, if the relationship isn't already there, it's not going to happen, because all of a sudden, as Senator Wild said, it's out of balance, it's out of kilter, and one side doesn't have a strong need for that settlement to occur. And when that need is gone, then the balance is gone, and when that balance is gone, then resentment forms, and when resentment forms, you have places like Fern Ridge or other places that wind up with labor unrest. And so I don't think that it's wise for this body to micromanage 200 school districts, or however many we have in the state of Oregon. I think that you need to, pardon?
286,
thank you. With all the mergers and the coming together of the smaller districts, I lost count. But I think that it's important that you have a formula and you have a way to designate that money, and then trust in your local school boards and trust in your community in how that money is going to be used based on the community's needs.
But the problem is the community is not providing the money in the old sense of the property tax. So if the school board agrees to spend more than what would be allocated under the formula, their recourse is to come to the legislature and request, demand more additional funding because of the commitments they've made. And I mean, that's the nonsensical part of it. So we, in essence, what we do is it's theoretically unlimited, and I realize it's not unlimited, but we don't control or have any real say in what the spending limit is, even though we're providing over 70% of the funds. And that throws the rest of the government into not turmoil, but it creates a real problem. And so that's the niche that 1181 is trying to find. And the answer is, if the school board wants more money, then every 2 years they can come and argue for a higher percentage.
So can anybody, though.
And they do.
In any, right. That's the process.
And that's the process of the money coming out of the general fund.
And Neil makes a good point. I want to talk a little bit about myself also. I mean, I know the way has gone out of the way to make me look bad and Neil look bad, and they put things out that I think are very unfair, but that's their business. They can do it as they wish. But myself, having been in business insurance for 30 years, I have probably donated more money to get school budgets passed, many thousands of dollars, and I've worked on many, many campaigns to get school budgets passed. So you can't class me as being an anti-school person, even though I know you feel that way, because I felt that in your testimony today, all three of you, as a matter of fact. That's okay. But I would point out to you that, you know, we do have a problem, and we have to resolve it somehow. I think that the public, and I think the gentleman, Michelle, from Wisconsin, talked a little bit about the feeling of the people on the community. They're not going to support schools when they go to ask for more money if they feel the distrust and the things that are happening in our communities today. And I think we have to try to resolve that if we can. And I'd also like to ask Ryan, you know, you talked about you didn't want to be measured. I don't know of any profession that doesn't somehow measure people. If you're a salesman, they measure by the amount of sales you make. If you're a truck driver, the number of miles you drive. But there are measurements for everyone. But what I hear you say, just give me the money and don't worry about how good I am. And I'm not sure that we can do that. We have to have some sort of measurement or some, and if the one we have here isn't the right one, help us develop one that is. But there has to be some accountability in the school system, and you have to be able to measure people as to what are they accomplishing. But just to say, give them the money and don't worry about it, it won't work.
Can I respond to that comment? Sure. In my testimony, my piece in terms of evaluation, I don't believe that it's fair that in my particular teaching assignment,
mm-hmm.
where I work with third, fourth, and fifth grade emotionally disturbed children who are required to take the state testing, because many of those kids, some of them are on an IEP, and some of them on their individual education plan allow them to be exempt from that testing, in which case that would negate this argument. But there are about half, a little bit over half, that do not qualify for that and have to take that testing. What I'm saying is if it's up to the district to put in a piece of my evaluation that is based upon the performance outcomes of those students, students who continually perform poorly because of extremely extenuating social potentials in their home lives that they bring to school, that have no relation to my effectiveness as a teacher, I believe that's unfair. At the same time,
think your administrator would know that? I mean, your administrator would work
logically. Logically, yes, I believe they would, Senator. But I'm just saying the language isn't in there. That was my point in my testimony. The second piece then is that, in terms of my own professional evaluation, my own district has recently offered a set of standards that teachers will be evaluated on. Now, above and beyond what's going on with 1181, that our assistant superintendent and leaders amongst our teaching staff sat down for 2 years and hammered out a set of standards, goals that we all agree on as staff within our district to hold ourselves to, and that our evaluations will be based upon. It includes evaluations, and it includes some work samples, and most importantly, it includes those standards around which we feel we should fairly be judged on. I expect to be held accountable to every single one of those, and I push myself to do that. I am a leader amongst new teachers within my district, and I promote those. So I see how my testimony could have been misconstrued in your part to say that, you know, I just want to do my job and get my paycheck. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is, if 1180 should pass, I don't see in there the language that would prohibit a district from allowing them to evaluate me based purely on just a test score.
Do you think that your administrator would do that?
In my particular district, absolutely not. So a very good working relationship with them, and I don't believe that would happen at all.
Okay.
May I, Senator Dirfler, in the collaborative process that we've testified to you this evening, there is a basic rule that you can be hard on the issue but soft on the people. And so if you heard this evening that we were being hard on you as an individual or criticizing you for not caring about schools and education, that was not our intent. But we do feel hard about these two issues in 1180 and 1181, and that's what we were speaking to, not your motives or your intent or what's in your heart.
I appreciate that. I'm not sure that you're already felt that way. Did you have any other questions?
No. Thank you for testing. I've enjoyed the dialogue, and Ryan Hagen.
Okay.
I don't think any administrator would do it.
And did you want to have a word? Okay. You had your hand up first. So you have 10 minutes that you have to see this with the test play.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim Nesbitt. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon State Council of Service Employees at FEIU. Our council represents 28,000 public and private sector employees in Oregon, and we're appearing in opposition to Senate Bill 1181. Two sessions ago, this legislative assembly made significant changes to the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act based on the theory that some subjects, so-called permissive subjects, like those affecting the assignment of work, should be left to management's discretion in the bargaining process. But the argument was made then that these changes to PECTA did not diminish bargaining rights over core issues like pay and benefits. Now the proponents of
Senate Bill 1181, want to have it both ways. Having narrowed the scope of bargaining over non-economic issues to taking dead aim at the most fundamental subject of bargaining, pay and benefits. In our view, Senate Bill 1181 creates an arbitrary ceiling on the obligation to bargain over pay and benefits. But we'd oppose any ceiling on the right to bargain over any issue. If you believe in the right of workers to bargain collectively, you allow the bargaining process to determine what is reasonable and affordable. Collective bargaining may have its foul lines that set limits on what can be bargained, for example, the mandatory versus permissive subjects. But it cannot function when the end zone for bargaining can be set unilaterally by either party. Senate Bill 1181 not only tilts the playing field, it changes the game. A process that ends with a unilateral qualified economic offer is not bargaining. And let's be honest, Senate Bill 1181 eliminates bargaining. Further, the ceiling imposed by Senate Bill 1181 is arbitrary. What's the justification for a ceiling of 3.8% if we experience a period of double-digit inflation, or if market forces create high demand for teachers that require higher pay, or if temporary budget constraints put one district far behind another in pay and benefits, and it needs to catch up? Compensation increases in excess of 3.8% may well be warranted by any of these circumstances, but how much more than 3.8% may be appropriate should be left to the bargaining process to determine, not removed from the table or shut off from further discussion. Further, in Senate Bill 1181, we have a form of wage controls, which ought to be anathema to defenders of the free market, including those who defend free collective bargaining. It's wage controls, but wage controls for teachers only, not administrators, not principals, not superintendents, not other school employees. The bias in this bill is evident. Also, we point out, as I think others have made this point, you already control the amount of money to be allocated to school districts by a formula which takes into account both inflation and student enrollment growth. And that formula dictates what we call current service level. And that's a budget decision you make in allocating that 70% of the funding that goes to school districts. So you already have significant control. It's important at the local level to retain local control over how those dollars are spent. And finally, we want to make the point that to impose this kind of ceiling on economic issues in the bargaining process will distort the bargaining process, forcing employees to shift in their bargaining, to shift emphasis to non-economic issues as a way to compensate for a limit on economic issues. And I speak from the experience of having bargained the large state contract for three cycles. There's kind of a Gresham's law here. Just as bad money drives good money out of circulation, with a ceiling on economic issues imposed in the bargaining process, you can expect secondary issues to predominate as the focus in bargaining will shift to those non-economic issues. In summary, we believe Senate Bill 1181 is unwise, unneeded, and counterproductive. And we urge you to reject this assault on what is the collective bargaining rights of public employees. Thank you.
Okay. Questions?
Wasn't current service level $4.65 billion for K-12 education?
It may well have been. I'm saying that is part of the formula that you take into account.
Right. But guess what? $4.65 billion is down the tubes from long ago.
And it may be well that it is, given the needs of all the school districts as they're advocating them. I'm saying that you start with a formula based on current service level.
Well, I guess, but my point is that because of the advocating in this building, we can't even stay at current service level. And furthermore, all of those current service level budgets that we have, all of the other budgets, are being asked to take a 4% decrease in their administrative costs, personal services, capital outlay, and administrative costs. We are not only are we not staying at current service level for K-12 education, we're going above that, or it's being talked about at any rate, negotiating through the media, but they are not being asked to take that 4% decrease. So there are no controls the same way as we have with state agencies. It simply is not there. It's a good concept, but it does not exist in reality.
Okay.
if I can respond, Senator Chisholm, what I'm saying is that you control the budget process, and you have a number of factors, including a formula which gives you a current service level and gives you a number based on current service level. You have a lot of other factors, and I don't envy your decisions around having to balance demand for funding for services, which you are going to judge to be more or less compelling. And that's all part of the process. But it's part of a budget process by which you arrive at an allocation of funds to school districts. And we're saying that is your control, and that's the control you have in the current process. We don't think it's appropriate to shift the burden, like Senate Bill 1181, to the local level in order to try and address what you may perceive as a difficulty in balancing competing demands for funding. We think that's the budget process, and that's when you're going to have to decide.
Well, obviously, if we're hoping to be able to solve some problem with this, if it doesn't, we're going to have to take a look at statewide bargaining, and that's maybe the other direction we need to go. If this is not going to be a satisfactory move, so obviously we're going to have to get a handle on this thing somehow, because I guess that would be our next direction to go. So we do appreciate your testimony. Thank you. Thank you very much. Maybe late this hour, we're going to adjourn. I know there's a couple other people who want to talk, but maybe they can catch us this time. We're going to adjourn the meeting.